Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps decision on City and County of San Francisco versus the Environmental Protection Agency. Speaking with us today, we have Jim Burling, who is Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation and author of a new book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker or his book, his full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, you could enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker and not the Federalist Society. With that, Jim, thanks so much for speaking with us today. I'll hand things over to you for a breakdown of this decision.
All right. It's great to be with you. And in this case, San Francisco versus EPA, we have basically a strange bedfellow department where you have on one hand San Francisco, which is a bastion of environmental consciousness, filing a lawsuit against EPA where industry players right and left joined San Francisco in challenging this particular Clean Water Act regulation. So what's going on here? Under the Clean Water Act, nobody can put pollutants into a waterway unless they have a permit from the EPA. So San Francisco has a bit of a problem. They have a very old, antiquated storm sewer system, and they have sewage treatment plants. And they have them combined, which means that the particular treatment plant that's at issue here, called the Oceanside Treatment Plant, basically takes sewage from about 250,000 people, about 250 miles of sewer lines, and treats that and then puts it into a pipe which goes out into the Pacific Ocean about 3 miles away, 3 miles out into the sea. But the storm sewer system is also part of this process. So whenever it rains in San Francisco, which it does frequently, especially in the winter, all that rainwater gets funneled into the sewer system, which gets funneled into the sewage treatment plant, and there are overflows, exceedances. The stuff just overwhelms the capacity of the sewer treatment plant, and it goes out into the pipe into the Pacific Ocean. Now, for years, the Clean Water Act and the EPA issued permits, which meant at the end of the pipe, out of the outfall of the sewage treatment plant, the city of San Francisco had to meet certain effluent standards. So much pollutants, so much turbidity, which is the cloudiness of the water, so much garbage could go into the outfall, and it was limited. And this is the way that the Clean Water Act is supposed to limit pollution. But about 5 years ago, EPA was dissatisfied with the city of San Francisco's progress in eliminating pollution. And they started to impose another type of permit condition. And the permit condition was it was illegal to discharge to contribute to a violation of any applicable water quality standard for receiving water. And it was illegal to create pollution, contamination, or nuisance as defined under California law. So imagine that instead of being able to have a determination that you're violating because of the end of a pipe that comes out here, what the stuff comes out here, you're looking at the receiving water, which is the Pacific Ocean here, 3 miles away. So whatever gets dumped into the Pacific Ocean, combined whatever else in the Pacific Ocean, could mean that the city of San Francisco is out of compliance. And city of San Francisco is saying, but wait, we really can't control what is happening in the Pacific Ocean 3 miles away. More to the point, we don't know what's exactly happening out there 3 miles away. Yeah, we'll take samples, but we don't have any immediate feedback on what those samples look like. They have to be taken out of the ocean. They have to be analyzed. And by that time, it's a done deal. We may be in violation and subject to a great deal of fines and penalties. So that's the problem. There's also a problem of some cases where you have multiple dischargers. Now, not in this particular case for San Francisco, but some of the industry amici that filed briefs in support of San Francisco said, look, sometimes there can be, you know, a dozen or so contributors to the pollution in the waterway. And if we are held to a standard that says we're responsible for the cleanliness of that waterway overall, then, you know, we're being held liable for what other people might be doing. Now, some history here in the Clean Water Act is necessary to understand what the legal issue was. For many years, from 1948 to about 1972, we had various iterations of the Federal Water Policy Control Act. And it had receiving water standards, meaning the standards of compliance were based on how clean the water, the river was, or the ocean was, or the lake was, or whatever the water body was. And that created all sorts of problems, some that I had mentioned previously. It was difficult to know who was responsible for what. It was difficult to know what your particular contribution to the water's pollution was and how to clean it up. There were also various procedural problems that made it very difficult to enforce. It was basically the Federal Water Pollution Control Act was a mess. And that's why Congress reformed it in 1972. And one of the things Congress did in 1972 was implement this permit standard that I alluded to earlier, simply saying that nobody can discharge anything into a water unless they have a permit, and the permit will set those effluent standards. And that was the way things went for many years until EPA adopted in 2019 these new standards, these receiving water standards that made it illegal to discharge in violation of an applicable water standard in the receiving water. And so EPA sued and said, no, that is not what the Clean Water Act of 1972 allows. And, the Clean Water Act, San Francisco said it has these effluent limitations, these numerical limitations of what you can put in. It has technology-based limitations, that these limitations are based on what the technology can allow and what's economical. And there's some standards that say you can't put any pollution in under any circumstances, regardless of the cost, things that will kill people immediately. You just can't do that. There are technology-based limitations and best practices. What is a best practice for a sewer system to limit pollution? And these are the standards that the city of San Francisco said were required. So they sued the EPA and they lost at the Ninth Circuit. There was a dissenting opinion, and they then petitioned for cert to the Supreme Court. And in their petition for cert to the Supreme Court, City of San Francisco said, this opens up to just tremendous liability because we don't know when we're going to be sued. But because the receiving water standards are so difficult to understand and comply with, we could be sued at any time. And in order to make their case, shortly after City of San Francisco and County of San Francisco filed their petition for cert, they were sued again by EPA and an environmental group, Baykeepers and others. And the city is claiming that this could cost them, these lawsuits and the cleanup that would be required could cost them billions of dollars. So there is a lot at stake, and the gravity of what was at stake was highlighted by the lawsuits that were filed after cert petition was filed and before the reply brief was filed. And so San Francisco obviously raised this in the reply brief. So let's get to the technical nitty-gritty details. Section 1311B1C of the Clean Water Act, it talks about limitations. And San Francisco argued that all such limitations imposed under Section 1311 must be effluent limitations. That is, limitations on the stuff that comes out of the pipe, not limitations based on what happens at the receiving water. And the court said that, no, you failed because the text of the statute refers to any more stringent limitations, including other limitations, which could include the receiving water limitations. So that argument that the 1311 only allows for limitations of the end of the pipe limitations did not fly with 8 of the justices on the Supreme Court, 5 justices on the majority, or 4 justices on the majority, I should say, 4 justices in the dissenting opinion. And Justice Gorsuch did not join part two. He thought that apparently San Francisco's argument made sense. He did not have a written opinion, but apparently he agreed with San Francisco's argument in part two. So you had 4 justices and the majority agreeing that part two, that San Francisco could not say that the language of 1311 limited discharges. Limited the effluent standards only to discharges at the end of the pipe. And the 4 so-called dissenting justices, and I'll get why I call that so-called in a moment. So that was that normally would have been the end of it, that the main argument that San Francisco brought, that Section 1311 did not allow for anything other than effluent standards, end of the pipe effluent standards, it lost. So end of the case, right? Wrong. Then we move on to part 3. And here the majority made what I would call a structural history argument of why these receiving water standards violate the Clean Water Act. It was for a different reason than the what was discussed in Section 2. And in Section 3, the court focused on the language of the statute that says any more stringent limitation, a limitation necessary to meet water quality standards, or something that you were required to implement. And those are all quotes. And the court focused on the word limitation in that context. And it turned to the trusty Webster's dictionary. And I quote, a limitation is a restriction or restraint imposed from without rather than internally. And then the court continues, and I'm going to quote this, but when a provision simply tells a permittee that a particular end result must be achieved, and that is up to the permittee to figure out what it should do, the direct source of the restriction or restraint is the plan that the permittee imposes on itself for the purposes of avoiding future liability. In other words, the direct source of the restriction comes from within, not from without. So this within, without dichotomy, based on a Webster's dictionary, is, well, Justice Barrett, in her opinion, called it puzzling. I would call it curious. It is perhaps not the most overwhelming, hit over the head example of textualism that I've seen. But this is what the court based its first part of Section 3 on, simply saying that the implementation of a regulation, if it's imposed externally by somebody else, that's okay. But if you're simply telling the permittee how to come up with a plan to do it, this is something you're doing internally yourself. It's the within part of it. And that is a violation of the plain language of the word implement. The dissent also pulls out its dictionary and says, not so fast. Implement could mean other things as well. Be that as it may, that is the nub of the majority's opinion, joined by 5 justices, including Justice Gorsuch, who did not join in part 2. Now, the court continues. I think the court must have realized that there's got to be more than that. And so in part 3B, the court embarks on what I call kind of a quasi due process, fairness, arbitrary and capricious like argument that the receiving water standard is unfair when there are multiple dischargers, and unfair when a violation cannot be avoided or ascertained in advance. So there's a taint of unfairness about it. But are you saying, Jim, that this is a substantive due process argument? Well, not exactly, because what the court does is go back to the original passage of the Clean Water Act, where the Clean Water Act itself was in response to the unfairness, due process type of violation, the arbitrary and capriciousness of the prior Federal Water Pollution Control Act, that was replaced by Congress. So essentially, Congress saw the due process, fairness, arbitrary and capricious problems of the prior act, amended the act, with the Clean Water Act to avoid those problems, meaning that any interpretation of the Clean Water Act must take into account those issues of fairness and due process as part of the understanding of the plain language of the text of the Clean Water Act. Now, I know that's a heavy lift for some of you. It's kind of a heavy lift for me, but I think that's the way the court is justifying talking about these fairness issues that would otherwise be considered part of maybe a substantive due process argument, which, of course, nobody on the court likes substantive due process, do they? That's a facetious aside. Now, the dissent, of course, says, no, look, if you're worried about something being arbitrary or capricious, say that it was arbitrary and capricious. Indeed, San Francisco at the trial court level argued that the statute was unfair and fattening and arbitrary and capricious, but it lost that at the Ninth Circuit, and it did not pursue that argument at the Supreme Court. But the majority opinion says that since the Clean Water Act was amended to avoid the sort of unfairness that we saw in the prior statute, that was enough. And that's how we interpret the statute in light of the unfairness that prevailed before. The dissent argues that there's a lot more wrong with the Federal Water Pollution Control Act than the standards, the receiving water standards. So these standards are really not inconsistent, the dissent says, with the Clean Water Act. But that was only 4 votes. And the majority, and I'm quoting here, before 1972, the Water Pollution Control Act contained a provision that did exactly that is receiving water standards, in no uncertain terms. But when Congress overhauled the Water Pollution Control Act in 1972, it scrapped that provision and did not include in the new version of the act anything remotely similar. Under these circumstances, the absence of a comparable provision in the Clean Water Act is telling. This glaring void resulted from a deliberate and prominent policy choice. In other words, the court majority is not making a policy choice here. That was made by Congress in 1972. And the majority also found that there is a permit shield provision in the Clean Water Act. That is, if you get a permit from the EPA to discharge pollutants into a waterway meeting effluent standards, and you meet those effluent standards, you can't be sued if you're meeting the permit requirements. But that is impossible, the court said, with this receiving water standard, because you don't know if you're in violation or not. So the permit shield provisions are basically eviscerated by these receiving water standards. It can take months to determine a violation. Here, the penalty sought, says San Francisco, could cost it $10 billion. Even in San Francisco, that's real money. And there should be finally no deference under Loper Bright, the case that overruled Chevron. So no more deference. And the dissent says that, you know, it totally disagreed. And they also talk about there's a yuck factor. It talked about breaches, water quality standards, including, quote, discoloration, scum, and floating material, including toilet paper in Mission Creek. Pretty gross, but really not germane to the statutory interpretation. Now, you notice I've been sort of hemming and hawing about whether this is if the four justices were a dissent or a concurring opinion. They said, Justice Barrett's opinion said, it was concurring in part and dissenting in part, so it's not a full-on dissent. That would mean that part two would get, if it was a concurring in part, it would get 4 votes for part two. The majority had 4 votes for part two. That would make that a majority opinion. But since it seems to be a dissent because it is agrees in judgment, but it doesn't say it so in so many words, is it a plurality opinion or is it a part two, or is it a majority opinion? It's a little unclear. Other commentators are equally uncertain about exactly how to treat this thing, just because Justice Barrett did not say it was an outright dissent doesn't mean it wasn't. So there may be some discussion of that. And lastly, question has arisen, what does this mean about where Justice Barrett is heading? Some of you may have seen Josh Blackmun on the Vala conspiracy, has been very, very critical of Justice Barrett, saying she's sliding rapidly to the left She may not yet be, in his words, a full-on suitor, but she certainly seems to be emulating a Justice O'Connor, being somewhat in the middle in these issues. And he is dismissive of some of her opinion writing as well. I'll leave you all to read that. But it does raise the question of, in the future in the Supreme Court, what the majority will look like. Will it be a majority of some of the liberals joining with Roberts and Barrett, or just Barrett to have certain results? There's a great deal of uncertainty there. But with that, I think that is a full rundown of the decision of San Francisco versus EPA. It is, I think, a fascinating decision that will have a significant impact on trying to figure out where textualism and due process fit together in a case like this, and what this also means, of course, for trying to comply with the EPA water quality standards.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that breakdown, Jim. We do have several questions from the audience. One is just a clarifying one. Did San Francisco argue the within-without distinction explicitly regarding the word limitation?
Not that I recall. Certainly, it didn't come up in the oral argument that I recall, and I don't recall seeing it in the briefs. It may have been in an amicus. I mean, I admittedly didn't read every amicus brief in this. I have a real job. But it was an argument that kind of surprised me to see this decision based on the within-without internal-external sort of dichotomy in the Clean Water Act and the Webster's Dictionary. It's one that if I had seen it, I probably would not have paid a great deal of attention to it previously.
Yeah, certainly. And we also have a question wondering whether you can touch on the reference in the new standard to nuisance law.
So this gets back to the part, there were two parts to the new standard. And one was it is illegal to discharge or contribute to a violation of any applicable water quality standard in receiving water. And the second part said it's illegal to create pollution, contamination, or nuisance as defined by California law. And the California law would be California water quality standards, California pollution law. And so the idea is that if you are violating a state law, then you are also in violation of the federal Clean Water Act permitting regime. So when they talk about nuisance, you're talking about the nuisance. It's a nuisance to dump bad stuff into a water. The insulation that you normally would have had under the Clean Water Act by complying with a permit is almost impossible to have that, as I said, the permit shield, because it's really impossible to know whether or not anything you're doing is creating a nuisance that could basically obviate everything else, even if you've complied with the effluent standards themselves by the end of the pipe stuff being okay. If you have created a nuisance, which could eventually be determined by state of California, jury trial, who knows, it makes it very unnerving for a discharger to not know exactly where that discharger stands in relationship to compliance with the permit standard. If it's based on something as somewhat amorphous as state law, nuisance, contamination, or pollution law.
Yeah, and along the same lines of not knowing exactly how much you're contributing to that nuisance, someone from the audience wonders whether there's technology that exists to actively monitor the amount of effluents at the end of these pipes, and if that data could solve these issues.
Well, yes, there is technology to monitor what happens at the end of the pipe. The problem here is that the newer standards, the ones adopted in 2019, require you not only to figure out what happens at the end of the pipe, but what happens in the overall receiving water, which could be the ocean generally in the vicinity the lake or the stream or the bay or the estuary or whatever. So it's not simply monitoring the stuff that comes out of the pipe, because that you can have sort of immediate feedback on. But as the court pointed out, sometimes, or San Francisco argued, it could take, you know, quite a while to figure out whether you have been in violation or not by trolling the sea, if you will, for standards in the vicinity. And so it's much more difficult to find that out. And by the time that happens, the stuff is out. It's gone. So, you know, San Francisco, in its plant, on the onshore sewage treatment plant, it knows what's going into the pipe before it gets out to the ocean. But once it gets to the ocean and it's mixing with everything else, especially in those cases, which is not this case of the Oceanside plant, but other, some of the, as I mentioned before, some of the amici industry pointed out, they could have 9 or 10 dischargers going into a water body and trying to figure out how they were contributing to the pollution, contamination, or nuisance is a difficult burden indeed.
That all makes sense. Thank you. And one last question that I have, just looking forward, how much of an effect do you think this will have on future EPA regulations and agency rulemaking in general?
Well, I think this and the loss of the Chevron deference is going to require agencies to hew much more to the statutory language and not get creative about it. Look, EPA didn't think that the Clean Water Act standards and system that it had in place prior to 2019 was adequate to do the job that it thought needed to be done. And instead of asking for Congress to amend the statute, EPA decided that it could come up with a better idea to have these kind of new standards based on the receiving waters, and this could solve the problem. Well, EPA may well have been right. This kind of standard is a huge cudgel on any potential polluter, and it certainly got their attention. But the question was, did EPA actually have the authority? Did Congress give EPA the authority to do that? And the answer is no. There's no deference to the agency anymore. And the court just didn't think that the Clean Water Act gave the EPA this authority. So in relationship to other EPA regulations or agency regulations writ large, just because a statutory scheme seems to be inadequate does not give the agency license to amend that statutory scheme by creating new rules and new regulations that go beyond what the statutory scheme actually calls for. This and the recent administrative law cases out of the Supreme Court show that the court is very concerned that agencies hew the statutory line and not go beyond what the statutes say. Now, some people think this is a court's arrogation of power. We had, for example, after the Sackett decision dealing with wetlands in the Clean Water Act, all sorts of people criticizing the Supreme Court for going too far in rewriting wetland definitions. But what the court is really saying is that, look, if you don't like the current state of the regulations that are based in statute, the answer is not to expand the regulatory authority sui sponte, but the answer is to get congressional authorization to do that. It is a demarcation of the lines between the congressional power, the executive power, and the judicial power. And what the court is saying is basically taking power away from the executive, the administrative agencies, and giving it back to Congress.
And now that the court has done so, do you think Congress will amend the statute?
Yeah. Will Congress do anything of any substance? I would hope. I mean, I'm the eternal optimist, right? And I've been litigating these issues for 41 years. My hope is that the Congress, now that it cannot rely on the agencies to do its dirty work, that Congress may actually have to get more into the weeds and look at the laws that it has and reform those laws. Will it actually do so? Well, sausage making is a very difficult proposition, and we see the difficulties that we have right now with a very divided Congress. And I think it's going to be, sadly, quite some time until Congress gets its act together to do any kind of meaningful reforms to anything until the Democrats and Republicans can get together a little bit more than they have lately and sing kumbaya, not make speeches from the, I won't go into that. But, if they were to focus on legislating rather than speech making in front of cameras, maybe we would. But will that happen? Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, only time will tell. Well, on that happy note, I'll give you the opportunity to say any last closing statements before we end this.
Yeah, I think this is, as I said at the outset, fascinating decision because it shows where the court is going. I think you should read part three of this decision, if nothing else, for an examination of how the court is combining an adherence to textualism with sort of looking at behind the curtain of what the statute actually says and what Congress meant that statute to say, without getting into intent to interpret the law so much as intent to understand what the law means. That's a very subtle distinction. And whether that distinction can bear the weight that's put on it, time will tell. But I think part three is much more fascinating than your typical getting into the weeds, effluent standard type of dispute.
Great. Well, thank you so much on behalf of the Federalist Society for speaking with us today. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for your active participation. We really appreciate it. You can stay up to date with announcements or upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thanks once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.